Good evening. Welcome to the Solaire Report. Today is June 11th, 2015. I'm Catherine Alston Fitz. I'm delighted you could join me this evening. It's good to be talking to you from Hickory Valley, Tennessee, instead of someplace on the other side of the world. Our theme tonight is Power Shift, and we are in the middle of a very big one. I interviewed on Tuesday Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur, who will publish her interview next week unless events in the Congress inspire us to accelerate. We may do that a little bit sooner. We'll see. And then last night I interviewed with Dr. Joseph Farrell for 2 hours, and we talked about the changes that are occurring in the world as we speak, inspired by the Bilderberg meeting, but we're really talking about changes in the governance system. And I want to talk about that tonight as our theme. We're watching 3 agreements. One is the Trade and Service Agreement, one is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the final one is the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. And Joseph and I, in our interview, talk a lot about the whole nature of the three together. Congresswoman Kaptur and I talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is will probably go for a vote in the House tomorrow. It may be in serious trouble. Let's hope so. So let's talk about what this is, because these are being described generally as trade agreements, but they're more than that. Congresswoman Kaptur described them as treaties. They're a fundamental re-engineering of the global legal structures, and I think it's important to step back and look at them. We did a special report in the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's up on the website, and we've made it public now, so it's easy to see. You can see in the under special reports in the left-hand side of the homepage. And I would really encourage you to take a good look, because it's a good framework and overview of what we know about it so far. What we're watching, and this is the next step after the bailouts, I've described many times the fact that I believe that we saw approximately $40 trillion in capital moved out of global, what I call global 2.0, particularly sovereign governments. Liabilities moved back in, and those assets moved into what I'm describing as global 3.0, primarily in private investment pools and corporations. And when you step back and look at these three agreements, at least what we know about them, what you're watching is the next step of changing the global law and regulations to really accelerate that global 2.0 to 3.0, in particular to make sure that global 2.0 can't reach out and claw back resources or tax or control 3.0. So we're really watching 3.0 pull away and leave the liabilities back in 2.0 with citizens to deal with them. So let's step back and look at some of the different aspects of this. First of all, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is essentially a re-engineering or a treaty between the Pacific Ocean G7 nations and some of their smaller allies. And the transatlantic is the equivalent for the Atlantic Ocean. So we're really seeing G7 put into place a new legal framework for how you're going to organize the management and allocation of resources within those territories. They're leaving Russia, China, and India and some of the BRICS out for now. And I think that's because they want to put the framework into place in the areas where they think they can implement and control. Clearly, this is a redo. If you look at what happened with the second round or the round after Uruguay, the Doha round of the World Trade Organization, it bogged down terribly and India got stuck. And so I think they're stepping back, re-engineering into the territory they control. Once they have their base strong, they'll turn around and then move in and deal with the guys right now who are running Plan B. So first of all, you know, characteristic number one is you're watching a fundamental reorganizing of the G7 territory with its smaller allies. The second thing is this is really about the rising of 3.0. Now that the bailouts and the various mechanisms have shifted the resources into 3.0 and government's really been exhausted with debt, a lot of this has to do with the great bull market in bonds being over, because you've about leveraged most of, not all, but you're coming into close to all of the capacity, so you've leveraged up the governments and pulled that money back. Now that you've got the resources across, you want to put up a huge wall to ensure that those governments cannot claw back the resources for corporations. So you're talking about fundamentally shifting the power between corporations and governments and putting more firewalls financially between them and governments, so that governments and citizens are going to be left to struggle with the debt and the liabilities on their own. So think of this as, you know, raising much more big firewalls to protect the resources you've moved into 3.0. Third, what we're about to see, it's happening now, but it's really coming in at an accelerating speed, is tremendous new developments in energy, in biotech and DNA, in artificial intelligence and robotics. And before that really goes up the S-curve, the corporations and the private investors want to make sure that they have very tight ownership and control of that without interference and regulation from government. And they want to make sure that they have a patent system in place that gives them the kind of intellectual capital and ownership that they want to have without interference or busybodies. Part of that is secrecy. So you're talking about a very significant amount of technology, including technology which has been financed by the taxpayers. But they want to make sure, again, firewalls between the governments and what they've got. They don't want to be transparent, and they want to make sure their ownership is very tight. It's important because this technology is going to be hard to control, and in some cases is going to be very dangerous in the hands of the wrong people. You get a very decentralized control of some of this energy and biotech technology, some pretty crazy things could happen. So there's definitely risk issues involved. And we're coming into a build-out, a period where we're finally going to get a build-out of the full internet system. Notice an announcement this week that SpaceX is launching another 4,000 satellites all to help build out the internet system. Coming into 2025, when we have all 7 billion people connected, that's when you're going to see some pretty explosive adoption, because you've got a ubiquitous internet everywhere. And so I think there's a real urgency on the part of the private investors and corporations to get this intellectual capital, new technology control framework into place. And that's one of the drivers, but there's more. We've seen the large corporations in the G7 go to extraordinary lengths over the last 20 years to aggregate and control as much of the economy as they can. And they're pretty much tapped out. It's part of why you see the stock market going sideways. A continual consolidation of the legal framework, sort of supporting monopoly cartels in a variety of ways, is going to allow them to aggregate even more. So this is a deeper push by the large corporations to increase market share by changing law and regulation. Finally, with the internet growing the way it has, you're seeing the whole military-industrial complex struggle with how to keep things secret. You know, how do you keep the breakaway civilization secret? How do you keep their growing global governance impact secret? How do you keep, whatever is going on behind the black budget and UFOs secret? It's getting harder and harder to keep that all secret. This framework really facilitates that, particularly with some of the things that you can do to use and control media and the internet. So I think another goal is secrecy. It reminds me very much of when Paulson came in asking for the first $750 billion of bailouts, basically saying, we can do anything we want. We can override the Constitution. We don't have to tell anybody what we're doing. And you wonder, Hank, who's blackmailing you? When you look at the letter by 7 former Secretary of the Treasury saying we must do this, you almost feel like, who is the biggest owner of all the bonds? Who is the creditor that controls the strings? And who exactly are you guys hawking for? Now, the weakness in the system, very beautiful article this week by John Rappaport, which we posted up on Solari.com. It points out the more you centralize, the more you aggregate the economy this way, the weaker the system gets. You know, it's the reason that market economies are so strong. If you don't use them, you're going to get a, you're going to consolidate the wealth, but you're going to get a weaker system. You're basically killing a lot of the group intelligence, and it's the fallacy at the core of the model. It's one of the reasons I wrote this week the reply to the Wall Street Journal about consumers being tapped out. When you destroy your consumers and you destroy their income and you destroy the base, the very foundation of an economy, if you destroy the trust in a system, then of course, you know, what you're going to get is you're going to get all sorts of deflationary behavior because people stop trusting in the system and stop taking risk. I continually am surprised this year that the Fed was surprised that the U.S. recovery didn't, but their idea of recovery didn't continue. I was really surprised that I would have expected a stall given all the different things I describe in that reply to the Wall Street Journal. But there it is. The Fed is surprised. But anybody living on the ground and watching what's going on in the economy is not surprised. And Rappaport's article does a good job of explaining why. Here's my prediction, though. If all three of these go into place and the liability protection that they're offering to large corporations is in place and confident, expect the equity market to rise, including in tech, biotech, AI, robotics, in those areas. You could see equity markets increase remarkably because remember, you've had very rich resources move over to 3.0, liabilities move back into 2.0, but the legal framework still is not there to protect them in all the different ways I've described. If this gets put in, we could really see the beginnings of a crash up in the equity markets. I know I'm always saying we're way overdue for a 10 to 25% correction, but a combination of these three agreements in place before the fall, you could really see a very strong move in equity valuations when those firewalls are put into place, and you get a fundamental shift in the powers of large corporations vis-a-vis governments and the governmental liabilities. So I think we could see a very significant impact on equity market valuations. The Trans-Pacific Partnership first test for the U.S., it's passed, or the approvals for fast track have passed in the Senate. It's going into, looks like a House vote tomorrow, so this could get very interesting. I would keep an eye on this, and if you get a chance, definitely take a look at that report or listen to the interview with Kaptur and the interview with Farrell. Very good discussion about that. Money and markets, the story in the markets, and we've been talking about this for a year on the Solera Report, is bond market jitters. Interest rates rising in G7 sovereign bond markets the last 2 days. They just backed off. The rise backed off a little bit. The World Bank is recommending to the Fed that they not raise interest rates. There's a lot of nervousness about what could happen if you raise interest rates here and the U.S. dollar flies up and a lot of the dollar borrowers around the world get put in that dollar trap. So clearly the Fed's under a lot of pressure over this whole issue. And I think all the different talk about Yellen, the investigations of Yellen and the potential leaks at the Fed and sort of the different politics give you a sense of how tough this whole issue is going to be. The economy is very soft. So at the same time, you got a lot of money in the fixed income markets looking for a place to go. And if you look at the places in the United States where the housing market is strong, I think that's one of the reasons. It's fixed income money looking for a place to go. The S&P turned up in the middle of the week. And so the S&P is now up 2.43% for the year. Gold is essentially flat. It's down 0.25% for the year. Silver still up 1.83, backing off from where it was last week. Oil is down about 0.75%, so generally flat for the year. The DAX, which is up, German DAX, which was up as much as 30%, is now up 16%. It's backed off. Same with China. China was up almost 30%, now up 17%. for the year. The developed markets minus the North America are now up 10%. Emerging markets still up 2.5%. So basically tracking with the U.S. markets. The bond aggregate, U.S. bond aggregate, now down 1.3% for the year. The long treasury down 6.4%. The treasury market still struggling. Interest rates up. The commodities index down 1%, and U.S. dollar index is now up 7% for the year. It's back down to 95. HSBC rocked the world and announced it's slashing 50,000 jobs. That's 20% of its workforce. It's refocusing on Asia. Expect that to be a sign of more. Two things, outsourcing of white-collar jobs globally, but also more jobs replaced by automation. So this is going to be something, sort of the re-engineering of the white-collar jobs is going to accelerate over the next couple years. And so expect to see a lot more of this. MSCI, big indexer for the global markets, particularly equity markets, announced a decision that it was going to include the Chinese A shares in its global indices and then turned around and backed off. First it said yes, then it said no. It's an indication that the Chinese markets have not yet achieved the international liquidity they need to, but they're on the way. And there is strong political pressure in the G7 to keep them out for a while longer. So that struggle is going to keep going back and forth. The politics of keeping capital from flowing to China and keeping it in the G7 is very strong. The housing market, I did a commentary last week or 2 weeks ago about the real strong effort by the administration to juice the housing market. And again, in areas of 3.0 reinvestment, it's strong. You know, you get reports of just tremendous strength in the housing market. At the same time, the administration's goals are clearly struggling in many areas because young people are just not buying homes. And one of the big reasons is student loans. So expect to see student loans a big hot topic in the 2016 elections. And I suspect the Democrats are going to make every effort they can to give some kind of relief to student loans. Commentaries this week, I've got a series of commentaries in addition to our reply to the Wall Street Journal. Two book reviews, one, Nick Bostrom's new book, Superintelligence, Path, Dangers, Strategies. Now's really the time to start educating yourself about artificial intelligence. It's rocking our world. It's only going to rock it more. Bostrom's book is a pretty serious look. There's a good introduction at in The Economist recently, and I posted links to those stories for those who don't have time to take a look at the book. Another book review on a new book on relatively new book on sovereign wealth funds. Sovereign wealth funds are now have about $6 trillion of capital. They're becoming an increasingly important part of sort of investment policy globally. And it's interesting because if you look at the nature of who they are and what they do, they have the ability to think and act very strategically long-term in ways that some other institutional investors do not. And we've seen examples, or the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund is a good example. The Scandinavian funds and pension funds have done a very good job of sort of thinking through long-term investment policy and strategic issues. So I've become increasingly interested in sort of learning about them and what they're doing. Then Report from Down Under is a umbrella report on my trip to Australia and New Zealand with links to all the different commentaries I wrote. I found it absolutely fascinating. And again, I'm going to be in Europe for 2 months in the fall. The reality is if you want to understand the global economy, you have to be there. And being there all over the planet obviously involves many places. Finally, Soleria's new crowdfunding, Liberty Bain, who was the eldest daughter of Franklin Sanders, a wonderful, talented woman who wears many hats. Anyway, Liberty's going to get a new coaching certificate. She's doing a crowdfunding, and if you are called to support just an extraordinary and special person, you can click on the link from the homepage. The title is Soleria's New Crowdfunding, Liberty Goes to Seattle. Our hero this week is a wonderful gentleman named Adam Warwick, who's a biologist working for the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, who pulled off a daring rescue on the Panhandle, a big 375-pound black bear, 6 feet high, made his way into a residential neighborhood. So the the conservationists shot him with a dart gun, a tranquilizer dart, to get him back into the forest, so they could carry him back into the forest. Instead, the bear decided to make way for the Gulf of Mexico and jumped in the water and started swimming. And given the effects of the tranquilizer dart, was likely to start to drown. So Adam jumped in and saved the bear. It's a very heartwarming story. You can find the link on the website. Ask Catherine a couple questions. Negative interest rates, does this mean a crash up in the real estate market? Not necessarily. If anything, real estate interest rates in the U.S. are probably headed up. If negative interest rates were happening and we're going to move in and happen to the consumer, potentially they could. But no, I don't think it necessarily means a crash up in the real estate market at all. What is driving the real estate market up is you have, again, areas that are receiving 3.0 reinvestment or bringing in foreign investment, or both, have some pretty hot housing markets and some hot real estate markets. But that's literally money and fixed income trying to get into something real. Catherine, I just listened to your conversation of negative interest rates. Towards the end, there was a discussion on gold. However, no one seemed to discuss this critical point. In the Depression, the government simply passed a law that required that people sell their gold to the government at a low price. With government stepping in to control everything, why would they not pass a law that makes it illegal to hold gold? Who would want to be holding an illegal asset? Why does no one speak about this risk? Franklin Sanders and I have spent an extraordinary amount of time discussing this very issue. And if you go into the Precious Metals Market Library, at various times we describe content, you can find it all. I've talked about it so much that I sometimes don't bring it up again. I'm assuming it's something we've covered many times, but I'm glad you brought it up. The history of the U.S. gold seizure, when they brought in the gold, is they passed a law saying people had to sell it or turn it back in. And the reality is, the people who didn't turn it in never were prosecuted. It's amazing how much gold stayed in personal hands, because at that time, gold was one of the biggest forms of personal saving. But with one exception, which Franklin and I discuss at length in our history of the U.S. precious metals markets, you may want to read that and take a look. It's got a lot of great stuff in it. Anyway, but with one exception, the U.S. never attempted to prosecute. So there was a great deal of gold they didn't bring in. But I agree with you, this is a risk. When I was on the board of GATA, GATA wrote a letter to the Treasury asking them whether they reserved the right to, you know, to basically seize all the gold. And they wrote a letter back saying, we reserve the right to seize all assets. It was very chilling. Next question. If the assassination attempts on President Ford and President Reagan had been successful, members of extremely powerful, wealthy U.S. families would have immediately become president. Do you think that this motive may have been in play in both the multiple assassination attempts on Gerald Ford and in the one attempt on Ronald Reagan? Yes, absolutely. I assume that that's the case. What's important to understand is, with the assassination attempt on Reagan, essentially an enormous shift of power was achieved anyway. Bush had made a deal as part of coming in as the VP that he would control the intelligence agencies, the National Security Council, and enforcement. That combination is unbelievably, essentially he was controlling the entire covert side of the House. With Reagan shot and sort of weakened, it just gave Bush much more power and control. So I think in a sense, a partial shift happened as a result of, one, Bush having that deal, but then Reagan seriously weakened by the assassination attempt. Hi, next question. I've heard you and Dr. Frell mention on numerous occasions that we weren't seeing price inflation as a result of quantitative easing, would you consider the epic bubble in stocks, bonds, and housing to be the price inflation one would expect as a result of money printing? Also, I never hear you speak about peak oil or peak resource. Could you explain how the elite can keep a system going that requires infinite growth on a finite planet? Dr. Farrell and I address those issues in the, or this question, because the questioner wanted us, wanted me to discuss it with Dr. Farrell. Two things I would point out. I don't think there's an epic bubble in stocks and housing. I do think there's an epic bubble in bonds. A bubble is when something is valued way above its value, if the price has been run up. What you're seeing in stocks and housing is a debasement of the currency. So that's absolutely an inflation effect, but I don't think it's necessarily a bubble. Also, although Farrell and I talked about sort of peak everything and peak resources, I would point out that infinite growth with intellectual capital is possible on a finite planet. And in fact, if you look at what could happen if we re-engineered the global financial system to equity, given that you can create equity value by healing, by ending poverty, by healing environmental damage, by growing intellectual capital, there is a way to get near infinite financial growth on a finite planet. So financial growth can be, in my opinion, infinite. Doesn't mean it has to, or that that's necessarily desirable. But I would encourage the person who asked that to listen to our full answer that I discussed with Farrell. Let's go to the movies. I invited you to watch Dr. Farrell's presentation at the Secret Space Program Conference. It was a fantastic introduction to this idea of the hidden system of finance and what happened to the Nazi loot at the end of World War II, or certainly the portion that was grabbed by the Allies. That's where Dr. Farrell and I start for this interview. It's very long. It's about 2 hours. It's very rich because we're basically trying to figure out together what is going on this planet in terms of governance and resource allocation. So we start with a recap of Joseph's first presentation at the Secret Space Program Conference, and then move through the Bilderberger meeting this year, sort of the history of the Bilderbergers and their meetings, how it relates to these hidden pools of capital, and then go into what we think is happening with these transnational agreements. Trade agreements that are really treaties and reengineering of the transnational legal system, and what it all means to different aspects of what's going on and where we think this is headed. Anyway, it's a fascinating conversation and really helped me to crystallize my thinking on what's happening with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Okay, that's it for the week. In closing, next week we have Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur, Ohio Democrat from the Ohio 9th District. I think as fine a public servant as I've ever known, and certainly my choice for favorite congressperson. I think she's simply an outstanding public servant. We will publish that interview openly, I think, in deference to her position. I want that to be public. And again, if the House goes to vote tomorrow, we may accelerate the publication of it just so that everyone has it on a timely basis. Today is a very good day to call your Congress critter and remind them to vote against fast-tracking or supporting the Trans-Pacific Partnership. June 25th, Unpacking Baltimore with Junius Ricardo Stanton. I want to cut through a lot of the lies on what happened in Baltimore. And talk a little bit about what's really going on in the inner city of these countries. Then the first week in July, we have our equity overview for the quarter. I'm going to do a little focus on the Australian and New Zealand stock markets, just because I was down there and want to talk a little bit, start talking about the stock markets in different places. And then the following week, we're going to have the second quarter wrap up, and our theme this time, last Last quarter was Planet Debt. This time we're going to be talking about infrastructure. Infrastructure is a very big topic, particularly with the development of the Asian Infrastructure Bank. So I'm looking forward to that. So until June 18th with Marcy Kaptur, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.